I just want to thank everyone for sticking around till the end of the conference here. It's been exhausting, I'm sure. So my name is Jonah Boswich. I work at Columbia University's Center for New Media Teaching and Learning. We're a service organization that works directly with the faculty. We help them use technology purposefully in their teaching and learning. So it's not departmental homepages, it's not distance learning, and it's not research. Our work begins where the course management system leaves off and really picks up with multimedia, annotations, collaboration. We're kind of the group you'd come to if you want to be exploring the use of social media or participatory media within the classroom. With that said, I kind of want to apologize that Anders Pearson can't be with us today. He was really planning on coming out, but came down with a case of not being able to make it to South by Southwest. I just want to start out by talking a little bit about education and why I think it has a lot to do with what we're all doing. From an abstract enough point of view, a lot of what our work is involved in the classroom is creating environments that really balance the flow of knowledge, communication, and power within the classroom. And in many ways, I really have seen that core problem, when viewed from that perspective, is the same problem that a lot of people have within their organizations, between their organizations and their constituents, between their customers and their companies and governments and citizens and stuff. So in many respects, the educational problem, you know, that we're trying to solve is really a microcosm or a model of many other kinds of problems. And in practice, a lot of the requirements that we encounter actually have a significant amount of overlap with the kind of community building that's going on in the nonprofit world and a lot of the kind of participatory culture that corporations are now just beginning to play with and experiment with. So keep that in mind when we look at some of these examples, because they carry over directly into a lot of other sectors. And they're really, there's a lot going on in the university setting, that's, you know, where a lot of experimentation is happening, on par with the experimentation in the 20s that a lot of the early filmmakers were conducting in terms of exploring the very possibilities of some of these new forms of media. I want to start out with a bold assertion that I caught Larry Lessig making this summer at Wikimania, where he talked about text being the Latin of our time and audio and video being the new vernacular as I remembered it. He called it the ordinary language of the people or the vulgar language of the people, but the new vernacular works for me when I talk about it. Even if these claims are only partially true, they actually leave us in a position where we probably need to be reexamining the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, in terms of what it's crucial that we convey to citizens, future citizens in the world. And to that end, I want to kind of just show people what a lot of what's been going on in education for a while. Our work involves not just the work with the undergraduates, but with the professional schools as well. A lot of what goes on in the professional schools is that the areas of study are so complex that case-based learning is very popular. And for a long time, video has been a really important way of conveying a lot of that information. And as you can see, one of our partners, you know, way back when, would often bring the videotapes into class and then allow his students just one opportunity to catch them in class. And if they missed it, they missed it. This particular form of engagement wasn't particularly engaging. They were passively consuming most of this media, and a lot of the themes explored this week have kind of grappled with some of the transitions that we're facing in that regard right now. And there are movements afoot to develop these forms of media literacy, as a lot of people are calling them. There's groups, a couple that I listed up there that I'm familiar with, that are based in New York City, that are working very closely with youth, to create youth media. And, there's a lot of thinking coming out of, the teaching communities that one of the best ways to teach media literacy is to have people produce and create media. Nothing too controversial there, I don't think, but a lot to chew on. You know, at the moment, what that means for a lot of folks is actually giving them, you know, little video cameras and having them go out and make films. I mean, talking about working with a blank canvas here. And, you know, a lot of the work that we're involved in has everything in the world to do with distilling and disseminating and making more available these tools of production to a wider audience. And I'm very interested in exploring, you know, something in between the passive consumption and the active creation against a blank canvas. Stuff that we're starting to see across the board in terms of all of the people that we work with is that people are beginning to save everything. I think I've begun to describe the era that we're embarking on as the end of forgetting. And I think that, you know, across the board, people are saving everything. They want it there forever. Another theme, which is probably worth thinking a little bit about in the context of a lot of what we've seen this weekend as well is what to do once you have all this access. So there's a lot of projects out there that really look at access as an end into itself. There's the access to knowledge work, and there's all librarian work, and it's critical work, no doubt. But I think that as educators, we can actually take this one step further and really, really push the levels of engagement with this media and begin to wonder what on earth we're going to be doing with, you know, these torrents of media as they begin to come in. So, you know, to the extent that iTunes U is on the verge of capturing at a large number of universities every lecture ever, you know, that's the C-SPAN footage and the MetaVid project. There's a bunch of, you know, torrents of information that are being, you know, captured and saved, and that it's really critical for educators to be conceptualizing how the students will actually be actively engaged in this media and working directly with it in ways that actually allow for them to critically and in-depth engage and analyze the work that's in front of them. So, let's see. We saw Henry Jenkins talk yesterday, and I didn't even know he was going to be here. So we have a little of his take on participatory culture, and you know, one of the things that we were hoping to mash up with some of the educational work that we've been doing with video. I don't know if anyone here knows recognizes that picture on the left or has ever seen the humpback's feed. It's a pretty incredible situation. The humpback whales, what they do is after migrating all the way across the ocean, when they finally arrive at the feeding grounds, you know, thinned out after all that swimming, they actually need to cooperate in order to feed. A couple of the whales have to swim in circles and create this little bubble net, and then a separate whale that's not the one who's capturing the fish, you know, has to scoop up in the middle and gets to eat them. And they need to trust each other and cooperate and rely on the fact that after one eats, that they're in turn going to help others eat as well. I thought that was actually a really nice way to kind of think about, you know, the trust, cooperation, and community that that people are. Beginning to rely upon in a lot of these settings. And, you know, we have some notions of annotating, appropriating, and recirculating, that are some of the ways to think about, participation. And you've got, you know, their equivalents in the marketing spin, as well as, standard constructivist theory that goes back to, earlier than Papert, back to, Piaget, I think. And you know, since we're working at the university, I figure I'd bring some stuff down from the ivory tower here. If anyone, I don't know if this is the right crowd for it, but if anyone's looked at some of the work of Lev Manovich, who wrote this book, The Language of New Media, I think some of the language that he introduces there is really, really, really helpful for thinking about what we're encountering here. Manovich talks a lot about the narrative and the database as cultural forms and puts those two in oppositions to each other. He's not actually talking about, you know, the physical instantiations of each of those, but he does remark on the tendency for new media to gravitate towards the database form, and certainly imagines hybrid forms emerging in the future where those will be reconciled. And I think a lot of what we're starting to see in Web 2.0 and with tagging in particular is sort of the reintroduction of narrative to database. And I think that, you know, people are in the midst of carving narratives back out of databases, you know, creating trajectories through these really, you know, immense data sets that that really need narrative, you know, for them to be compelling and meaningful, to reintroduce meaning back into the database will be one of the epistemological challenges of the upcoming century. And I think Will's keynote this afternoon kind of alluded to some of these ideas with his possibility spaces and, you know, some of what we're seeing in the emergence of interactive storytelling. I think we could, you know, even imagine Walter Benjamin, who anticipated a great deal of the angst that we're struggling with in the digital era, as having responded to this partially by anticipating or understanding ways in which collections in the end have auras. If people know the reference, way back when, you know, decades ago, he noted that one of the struggles in an era of mechanical reproduction is that we've lost the sense of aura and there's nothing special anymore. But at the same time, I think the collections that people are making, the narratives they tell, and the things that they're assembling, like, allow for them to reintroduce meaning in significant ways to the work that they're doing. Moving back into the real world, the world of implementation and not just theory, a lot of the work that we've been doing at the center has attempted to incorporate a lot of these ideas and principles. And One of the landmark projects that we've worked on is called Vital for video interactions in teaching and learning. And it's an environment that allows for the professors to, actually I have some screenshots up here, to display libraries of video in context for students. But then, crucially, it actually allows for the students to clip this video, to create segments, you know, just basically by annotating in points, out points, and some notes onto the video. They collect, you know, a whole collection of segments that are based on the clips that they're studying in this class. And then actually they are taken over to a workspace where they can begin to integrate the segments that they've clipped themselves from this video into an analytical essay that actually cites the segments of video like you would an ordinary textual citation in a traditional essay. And so, well, when the thing is playing, you get the idea, the little pop-up of the video. We've done similar work, when Václav Havel came to visit the university, there was a flurry of activity for over a semester. Incredible number of digital assets were generated from, you know, the podcast of his talk when he came to visit with Clinton to, you know, just a whole semester long of activity that kind of, spanned the entire university. And, you know, here was a treasure trove of assets. And once again, we were, ran up against this question of how to reintroduce opportunities for contextualization and meaning into those activities. And, you know, we put together this environment that allowed for students as well as faculty to create these notebooks whereby they would navigate, you know, the site and, you know, in a shopping cart-like way, you know, collect the assets that they thought were, you know, particularly compelling or important, and then assemble them, you know, in a setting where other people could see their walk through those assets. And, in addition to students engaging in these activities in the context of their classroom, you know, some of the hosts and we even had some celebrities like Lou Reed manage to come in and play with these notebooks in some of those settings. Sort of stepping back for a minute, and that's a little tough to see on this one. Maybe I should pull that up in a PDF. I can step people through some of this in a minute. We've been, you know, trying pretty hard to conceptualize and model a lot of the space of possibilities within the realm of participatory media. So in the case of Vital, what's going on there is that students are actually collecting these assets themselves, organizing themselves. We haven't really introduced folksonomic elements where they're sharing these elements with each other as much. That's certainly an option, but in this particular case, the faculty was far more interested in the individuals actually conducting and doing this work than he was in collaboration. But we do want to acknowledge in the tools that we build the possibilities for these different feature sets and really begin to kind of flesh out the full domain of possibilities when it comes to introducing these kinds of tools into these settings. And hopefully it's you know, becoming apparent ways in which a lot of these tools would carry over into other settings as well. So this is an argument that we've been developing to initially it's sort of an explanation that helps the faculty members understand the difference between wikis, blogs, and forums, and when you want to use each one and why. And you know, even more so, it actually serves to function as sort of an argument for ways in which these software environments that we're constructing are beginning to resemble more and more traditional architecture as a leading art. And what I mean by that is that just as architects will talk about constructing a space that's really conducive to people interacting and getting along with one another or walking through it quickly, the environments that we're building are mediating human-to-human interactions and, you know, thereby facilitating, catalyzing, or, you know, sort of shaping the dynamics of those interactions. And, you know, it's a short step from there to recognize ways in which the environments that we're creating are embodying ideologies and that people need to be really, really deliberate and a lot more self-conscious and self-aware of what it is that they're putting in front of their students. And so I often tell people to kind of convey this point that, you know, if they really wanted to and they ordered up an environment that, you know, encouraged competition, selfishness, and proprietary thinking, I could probably try to build them one that did that. Likewise, if they were interested in one that fostered community trust and friendship, it's now possible to begin to think about our design efforts, you know, from that perspective and that level of abstraction, and you know, to really be trying to get our faculty and users in the wider case to be focusing on the impact that they're hoping to foster. Again, you know, the cases of education end up being really, I think, salient to make some of these points. I think faculty members can instinctively recognize that, you know, sometimes you want your students to raise their hand before they talk, and sometimes you want people talking out of turn, like in a seminar setting. And, you know, we want to really be able to begin to think about translating some of those ideas over into the virtual world. None of this is deterministic. We're not naive enough to think that, you know, by introducing this, it'll necessarily play out that way. But to the extent that people are actually trying to be mindful of the impact that and the values that are at stake, really, beyond just the cognitive ones of the conveyance of subject matter. So I think, you know, in the talk just prior to mine, there was a lot of emphasis on instructional video, which, you know, is just this dissemination of knowledge in a lot of ways. But, you know, a lot of what we've seen at this conference, I think, has already gone a little bit beyond just that one-way communication. And once we're in this realm of two-way, many-way communication, there's a lot more at stake in terms of the values that are being imparted on the students and on the users. I went through those pretty quickly. I have a couple more thoughts that we can probably dive into or look at any of these applications a little bit more closely or explore some of the these ideas a bit. But meanwhile, why don't I pause momentarily and see if there's anything here that people wanted to kind of focus on.
It's on?
Hello?
Okay. You threw a lot at us. It sounds as if you're envisioning a scenario where universities and school systems are going to be kind of like YouTubes. And I was wondering is that really going to happen? Or are students going to be more drawn to the commercial closed alternatives? I mean, for example, the maybe not so much the annotation, because the annotation is a unique feature, but YouTube had responses, comments, and I'm not necessarily aware of what's going on in universities or high schools, but that was pretty much a advanced feature. And, you know, now everybody's sort of trying to imitate the social networking aspects of Google. And so my question is, isn't it possible that universities and high schools are not going to be involved in this movement?
That is a good question, and I think if they continue to leave a technology vacuum in place at the university, they're going to see a lot of their students, constituents, users actually flock to these third-party free-of-charge services. And to the extent that these vacuums exist right now, many universities don't even have calendaring solutions, never mind photo sharing or video sharing solutions. But part of what you're alluding to kind of speaks to the tension between, I think, this land grab for data, which I think Tim O'Reilly in his What is Web 2.0 essay, you know, talked really well about when he described this transition from software as an artifact to software as a service. And the land grab for data, I see it more and more as something that's potentially outflanking the free culture movement, and that universities really, really need to be taking a much more aggressive standpoint when it comes to recognizing the value of their brand and what they're losing every time a student leaves the Columbia.edu domain and, you know, wanders over to a place that's not safe, where their identity is not protected, where they can experiment and become in various different ways and forms. And, you know, to say nothing of the fact that, you know, you'd like to think that, you know, the knowledge at a university is their core value proposition, and that they'd understand that and respect that and realize that, you know, of everything, you know, it's the knowledge that's being generated there that is what makes them what they are, and, well, the knowledge in the communities that are being formed there. So, you know, I'm not proposing that universities all simply embrace the Flickers and the YouTubes of the world. I think they do need to acknowledge that those things exist. I think that hybrid models are certainly viable in terms of recognizing what can go on and what can't, but that they ought to be very, very conscious and deliberate about the things that are being conducted outside the umbrella of the university domain. So,
yeah, I have a question. If public schools become the petri dish by which, you know, we develop potential university students, what type of paradigm shift or basically breaking the model needs to take place to move from reading, writing, arithmetic to experience, create, and distribute?
Sure. That's a great question. I think really, to answer that question, I think we need to kind of back up and start asking ourselves what educates. And I think that right now what passes for education in a lot of people's minds is that which helps you do better on a standardized test or get a job. And when people start, you know, reconceptualizing education as, you know, that which helps one know oneself, or, you know, knowledge of the good, knowledge of the just, those kinds of things, I think it might help us reorient ourselves, you know, towards those efforts. As I understand, you know, the MacArthur funding, of which I think Henry Jenkins and Dana Boyd are pretty connected and involved with right now, is specifically beginning to explore and engage this question of, digital media literacy and what some of those values beyond the three R's might be. But beyond that, I think it's really, crucial to keep in focus the importance of the critical depth of analysis that we were all born and raised on. And so one thing that I often encounter or conversations that we have often at school, you know, kind of center around the giddiness around a lot of the collaboration that we've seen extensively at this week. And so, you know, have we sacrificed any of that critical depth? And are we looking at environments that people feel really good about but are somewhat more shallow? And that, you know, the quality of the work is degrading, even though, you know, everyone had a really good time making it. So those are issues that need to be carefully considered. And I think the balance, I mean, you know, that yellow space at the bottom there, is supposed to be value neutral. Obviously, some of my leanings might have become evident or apparent, but I do think it's really critical that there are different phases in people's educational careers where they do spend the time to cultivate their sense of autonomy, ego, and self, and that they actually, you know, engage in text and actually sit down and engage in text. At the same time, the ability for people to express themselves in a multimedia world, in a world where audio and video perhaps have become the new vernacular, means that, you know, these really are tools of speech. They are tools of creativity and speech. And, you know, if we went back to that Lessig quote, I think that, you know, he's making that claim that these really very much are the tools of reading and writing and the tools of free speech and creativity, in this era. So those become really critical. Yes.
Thanks. This is fascinating. Thanks for sharing. And my buddy here, Lydia, was just explaining to me that the Oxford English Dictionary was an original source for, it was a call for submissions, essentially. And I didn't know that until yesterday. And sort of fascinating how it was just open to the public, and there's lore of prisoners submitting a great deal of it. And that sort of leads to the quality issue you were just talking about, and Wikipedia, et cetera. What's your take on the value, increasing value or lessening value of open source collected information?
Sure. Well, there's open source, there's open content, and there's open code. And I wasn't sure at the end there which way you were going. I think that we've seen that there are often instances and cases where restricting the namespace of the participants can do a great deal in terms of you know, fostering the sense of community or the experience within the classroom. So to the extent that you know, sure, using Delicious and, you know, tagging everything along with the rest of the world has some nice aggregate effects if that's what you're after. But at the same time, you know, for a class to be working together, doing some distributed research across the current events that might pertain to their class, or everyone in a department or everyone in an institution, you end up with a very different quality and character of experience that might actually serve the purposes of the class better than, you know, participating with the entire world, you know, for just that project. So, you know, as far as the relationship to free software and open source, I think a lot of the values that we're considering here, I think you can make a fair argument percolate their way through the layers of the system. So to the extent that if what you're trying to do is foster a spirit of collaboration and community and trust, then I think you'll have a better shot of finding the features that support those aspects of community in tools that have been cultivated and born, you know, out of those processes. And so I think that that's a different aspect of this argument that we didn't really get to, but does play a prominent factor in considering it. So
this might be more of a comment than a question, but I'm actually working with a company right now, and we're actually doing a lot of this. And in the wild, where they're bringing in instructors, they're bringing in teachers in the public school systems, and they're creating lesson plans that are freely available to the kids in their schools, to anyone that has access to the internet. And so I'm already seeing a lot of this, and it's kind of one of those. Originally, when they came to us with the idea, I was like, you know, who's actually going to use this? But to actually see that this is where a lot of places are, you know, where we want to go. I mean, they're using YouTube and Google Videos to host their video for, you know, to teach history and to teach math.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's to the first gentleman that was up here, I was like, this is actually happening now.
Sure. And there's another force, you know, to consider in this case where, you know, in a lot of open projects, you know, you're relying on, you know, social capital or, you know, just the virtue of volunteering to participate. But, you know, in a classroom setting, you know, if your grade is contingent on participating, then, you know, you're there. And so, I mean, the students will be there. And if not, then that will be, you know, they're bound to participate as they would in any other assignment. And I think that also suggests other really interesting models whereby, you know, some universities and graduate programs could be taking, more of a civic-minded approach and actually, taking responsibility for some projects and maybe having, you know, their students or graduate students work through, you know, some of these, projects that are in the public domain and participate in tending to them and gardening them. And I think that, you know, you're really looking at tapping into a really large potential, you know, creative force to be engaged in some of those efforts. And certainly people are going to find these tools and will be bringing them over into the use in the classroom. And then the question is whether or not the university knows about it. It's fairly and evenly distributed across all the students, whether or not the university is benefiting from it in terms of, you know, the, alumni thinking back and remembering their experience as distinct and unique to the university, or it was just another experience on YouTube. So those are all really important things to consider. Thanks.
I'm with the University of Texas with the Division of Instructional Innovation and Assessment, and I would like to encourage everyone to take a look at what universities are doing. There is a lot going on. It's not enough yet. Education's broken. But the students of today, 50,000 students at UT walk around with an iPod stuck in their ears. You've got to reach those students. We did some studies and found that even though we did webcasts of a whole semesters and podcasting, and even with those, they attended class. That's what people worry about usually is, are they going to come to my class if it's webcast? They do. And they use these other technologies as study aid, support. They also participate on Blackboard or things that are made up by our group. So I really encourage people to go check out the websites of universities that are doing emerging educational technology and take a look at what they're doing, because it's evolving with the needs, and it's also evolving especially to meet the students' needs. It's giving students opportunity to do technological projects with faculty and get published and get awards for it. And even though UT is a Tier 1 research institution, and 90% of the awards are for research, 10% of them are for good teaching. And we're rewarding good teaching with integrating IT appropriately and effectively more and more. So go take a look.
Right. And, you know, people should consider, I mean, traditionally, I think there has been a cultural gap between a lot of the work that's going on in the nonprofit sector, you know, between the nonprofit sector and the educational sector, never mind, you know, cross over to government or corporate sectors. But nowadays, you know, with the rise of free and open source software, we've actually begun to prove and demonstrate, indirect models of collaboration, whereby people can actually be collaborating through, you know, this intermediate object of some code and not necessarily be bound to the same deadlines or be bound to the same bureaucracies or have to do all of the, you know, bureaucratic and administrative work to actually be directly collaborating on some of these efforts. And I'll tell you that, you know, of course, at the core, there's some foundational features that everybody needs in many of these systems, whether it's, you know, internationalization or better syndication or better handling of multimedia assets. I mean, these are problems that cut across sectors pretty widely. And so, to the extent that, you know, there are some incredible resources at universities, they just often operate at a slightly different time scale than the rest of the universe. But, you know, everyone's kind of in their own mindset and groove, but there are actually, demonstrated models of collaboration out there right now that are really, promising and compelling. So, let's see. I am going to be around, for the rest of the afternoon if anyone has any questions and stuff. If anyone else has anything that they kind of want to focus on or, you know, see some demos of the software, we've been doing a lot of work in this area, been struggling to liberate as much of it as possible. Many aspects of this development actually are open and free, and people, should definitely, you know, contact me directly or visit our website to see, you know, more of this kind of work and why it's really important. So thanks very much.